This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Flag Day was celebrated yesterday at the Military Museum and Library of Southwest Florida, and a unique piece of history, the dedication of a 37-star American flag dating back to 1867, happened. We'll talk with the museum curator and a flag expert about the story behind this earlier version of Old Glory. But first, early education in the years before kindergarten. They're seen by many as a critical time to get kids kindergarten ready so they can sprint into the education race on sure footing. But funding for that comes largely out of parents' pockets. And if those pockets don't contain a lot of extra money, sometimes those parents' 3- and 4-year-olds go without. There are programs like Head Start and VPK, which get money from state and federal sources. But according to a new study out of Florida Southwestern State College, that money adds up to a fraction of what is actually cost to get a child ready to go into kindergarten. Joining me now to talk about that study and how they came up with the hard numbers for the cost of educating preschoolers is Dr. Larry Miller. He's the Dean of the School of Education at FSW. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
We are talking about early education, how much it costs, and how much of that cost is covered by parents. Give us a call with your comments or questions at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Larry Miller, why is it important to understand exactly how much it costs to get a child ready for kindergarten?
That's a great question, Julie. Thank you again for having me. I think what we struggled with when we started this work a couple of years ago is trying to understand kindergarten readiness rates. And we wanted to know how many kids were entering kindergarten ready to learn because we were concerned about two things. One, the level of performance of students in our system, our college graduation rates, our high school graduation rates, those all relate to third grade literacy levels. And if you backtrack that all the way to kindergarten readiness and potentially even before that to what they're learning as 3- and 4-year-olds. We know that participation rates in VPK are around 79% statewide. So we were concerned about the 20-21% of kids not participating in VPK program, which is for a universal program for all 4-year-olds. We were also concerned that the state hadn't assessed kindergarten readiness since 2012-13. So there were competing factors there. We wanted to know more about the state of kindergarten readiness. And as we started to get evidence to come in about that, we found that in particular working with our partners in Collier County School District who implemented a kindergarten readiness assessment this past year, They found that about 28% of incoming kindergarten students were kindergarten ready on their literacy assessment.
Only 28% were
correct.
Ready.
So that's a very low number. And so that leads us to ask questions about funding, right, and resource levels inside of preschools that are responsible with getting kids ready for kindergarten and closing gaps before kids get into kindergarten, not after they arrive.
Mm-hmm. So only 28% of the kids – and I'm just kind of hanging my hat on these numbers because they're kind of new. But 28% were actually ready to go into school, into kindergarten. But what number – what percent were going to VPK programs to begin with?
The number that we have is about 80% for the county on average. But that number – I just want to be clear – we do have an NPR audience here, so that's an average, right, and it hides variation. And so we do have concerns about certain pockets of the community being less represented in VPK programs than others.
Yeah, I mean, the county is very diverse.
Diverse, very large. It doesn't include transportation, so if that's a challenge for families, those kids won't participate, for instance.
Yeah. So in your research focused a lot on the cost of educating kids here in Southwest Florida. Do you think there's a lot of variation in different regions of the state?
In terms of how much it costs to get children kindergarten ready?
Yes.
We saw some variation. It's interesting. In some ways, I think our study can identify variation in cost across our region because we do have very rural areas in Southwest Florida, and we have areas that are a bit more dense and concentrated that have more urban populations to serve. So, and our study does cover all five counties, which we drew those boundaries because that's the footprint that Florida Southwestern State College serves. So, in that area, we encompass, I think, a lot of the variation that is typical across the state, with the exception of what we may see in, say, Jacksonville or Miami-Dade. And the variation I think the regional cost variation that you're referring to is not as significant of a driver as the impact that poverty has and the rates of children served with special needs has on the cost of preschool.
That does have a huge impact, and you pulled those out in your mm-hmm. study too and specifically looked at those. So how much early education costs is really kind of hard to pin down. It's kind of a nebulous concept. So how has that been determined in the past?
That's a great question. First of all, the way that funding levels are set are generally through a political process and through what the market will bear, how much parents are willing to pay, how much income that they make, and how much aid is available to support them. From a research perspective, there are several methods that scholars use to try to estimate this cost. The professional judgment approach that we used in this study is one method. That method relies on the expertise of early childhood experts in the area that we're studying. That's one of the benefits of it. Other approaches include econometric models, what we call cost functions. Production functions are another approach. And then there's what we call gold study standards, where a randomized control trial is performed. And this has happened in a couple of studies related to Dr. Heckman's work. He's a Nobel laureate who has studied the impact of high-quality early childhood education on childhood outcomes and the return on investment of those investments for a community. So there's at least four different approaches that can be used.
So I want to take a look at the numbers real quick that you came up with. And you studied specifically five counties. In Lee, Collier, and Charlotte counties, the cost per student per year is about $12,035 to $12,062. They're pretty similar, the three counties. Then in Glades County, the cost per student per year goes up to $12,182, and in Hendry, it's $12,248. Is this the cost of preschool education based on a full school day or a half school day? Or because I think VPK only covers a certain number of hours.
That's a really good question. Those numbers and parameters were set by our panel experts. So I want to make sure that we're clear that when we came and convened those panels, our experts said, here are the standards that we expect for kindergarten readiness. They adopted those standards, and then we asked them, what resource levels would you need to get children to those standards? And they said, we need 6 hours a day in a year-round program.
So the methodology started with, here are professionals who know how to educate children. This is where they need to have the children educated to, like this degree of kindergarten readiness. And here is how you do it and how you get them there.
Correct.
And these numbers, this 12,000, these figures are based on what they would consider to be an ideal situation for getting a child educated and ready to go into kindergarten.
Correct. Except one thing I'll just add is the numbers weren't given by the experts. The experts said this is the duration of time. This is the curriculum and the assessment and the qualifications of the instructor. And then our research partners, APA, went and priced all of those resources. And that's what came to this number.
So that's what the ideal situation is. Do you know what the average cost is for VPK – or not VPK, but average cost that people are paying in these areas in our region?
We do. We tried to estimate that number. We think the number is around $6,500 per year per child that parents are paying for preschool.
And in most cases, is that also subsidized by money coming from VPK and Head Start programs?
You know, that's a great question. I wouldn't say that in most cases it is, because Head Start is a pretty small program for our region. In fact, Susan Block, who I worked with closely on this study, she is the executive director of the Early Learning Coalition for four of the five counties in this study. Mentioned to me, I think, when they were going after the early Head Start grant, there were requests for about $2 billion in funding, and I think the funding level came in at about $200 million for our state. So the demand, exceeds supply by a significant amount.
That was probably a disappointing phone call to get.
Yeah. So we avoided going after the grant because the competition was so steep.
So as far as money that comes in to help people, there are federal dollars and state dollars. State and federal combined, it goes through voluntary pre-kindergarten, mm-hmm. and that's a state program, correct?
Correct.
And then there's school readiness. What is that?
School readiness is actually kind of like a voucher. It's for families who meet certain income qualifications. They get support to defray the cost of caring for their child, developing their child from age 0 to 5 until they enter kindergarten, which it's funny. Then parents – I'm a parent. You mentioned you're a parent as well.
Yeah.
When your child hits kindergarten, it's a huge financial relief for those families because finally the state, local, and federal governments team together and provide a full day of
public
care
education.
And education for our children. Yes.
So when you put all of that together, on average, what you found is that all of the VPK, Head Start, the Department of Agriculture's USDA meal reimbursement, which is about $4. It ends up equaling about $3,720 per student per year.
Yes.
And so that does not begin to cover $12,000 per student per year. So that leaves a gap of about $8,300. Mm-hmm. How is that covered? And is it covered? I mean
– Right. So it depends, right? So some families that really value education and have enough funding to pay for education themselves, maybe – fewer children are able to pay that level out of pocket or even more. I'm not sure when I lived in New York City when my son was in preschool and our preschool up there was about $16,000 a year. I know the prices are a little bit lower here, but I'm not familiar what they are in private centers. But some folks may be paying more than that. A majority of the children in our community, though, are likely served at a lower level of quality and a lower funding level. So I mentioned before that parents are paying about $6,500 on average. But those parents who can afford $6,500 a year aren't receiving Head Start dollars typically, aren't receiving – they would only be receiving the VPK funding, which is about $2,300,
$2,400. So – Yeah, VPK is everybody, I think.
It is.
But yes. It still only covers 3 hours a day, I think.
Correct, for 9 months out of the year with pretty low ratios or pretty high ratios rather. The ratio is 20 children in a VPK classroom to one teacher. And they're four-year-olds, by the way. And now when you get into kindergarten, most of our districts set that class size at around 17, 18. So smaller when you're 5 than when you're 4, which is generally we go the other way with class size.
And that was another big part of the expenses that came into this equation to and this is, you know, best case scenario, $12,000 per student. And part of that cost was having the teacher to student ratio at 9 students per teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big cost factors.
Correct. Our panel recommended a couple of things. One, they recommended higher credentials for the teachers in the classroom, and I know we'll get into that in a minute, but also lowering the pupil-to-teacher ratio so that teachers have more time to work with students, right? There are opportunities to extend learning and provide more one-on-one support and small group instruction, which are important to getting kids kindergarten ready.
It would take a special kind of person to be able to actually wrangle in 24-year-olds.
It would indeed. There is also a ratio I learned about doing this work that the – I think the state standard for two-year-olds is 11 to 1, which scares me even more than
– Yeah. I just – I don't know.
We appreciate their efforts.
Yes, and that's why I'm in media. If you're just joining the show, we're talking about a new study that tallies exactly what it costs for a child to get ready to enter kindergarten through preschool and Head Start programs. We're talking with the author of that study, Dr. Larry Miller. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And one of the things that I found interesting, and when we talked earlier about the different rates at different counties, pretty much Lee Collier and Charlotte are pretty much the same. But when you get into Glades County, it increases by more than $100 per student. In Hendry, it goes up about $200 per student. Why are those two counties – why would it cost more in those counties?
Well, one of the big cost drivers out there is the poverty rate. The childhood poverty rate is much higher than it is in our area. Also, participation rates in VPK that we talked about being about 80% on average statewide. In Hendry County, I believe the participation rate is 55%. So it's a significant difference between that county's participation rates and ours. And then finally, I mentioned earlier, you know, transportation being a key driver. But I do want to dig into the childhood poverty rate for a minute and talk about that.
Because I don't understand how if there are children that are living in poverty, how would that impact the teacher per student ratio and the books and the crayons that they're going to need? I mean, how would it increase that cost?
Well, here's where I want to talk about what our experts said, right? So this isn't me. We convene these experts and then we listen to what they said, and folks who have taught children in classrooms like this and trying to get them to the standards we talked about. You know, poverty has a lot of deleterious effects, but one of them is that teachers need smaller ratios inside the classroom to provide more intensive instruction for those students to help remediate them. So that's a big factor. A second factor is that just like in Head Start, many people aren't aware, has a home visit program that's instrumental in its success. So social work and having that school reach out to the family in the home and extend the practices that are being introduced inside the Head Start program, or in this case a preschool program, and ensuring that those activities continue and are supported at home are critical. So our experts said if you were in a center that had, say, 100% of its children from poverty, which are common in our area, that you would need about one social worker per 30 children in order to conduct those home visits weekly to support that child outside the center.
So they need additional support.
Correct.
Because they're not maybe finding that at home, or is it difficult for the home to provide, I suppose?
I think there are a lot of factors, and I've never had that role. You know, I see that there are two sides, and your callers may be interested in this. I, you know, as an academic, what we often talk about is on the one hand, not having income above the federal poverty line is not a learning disability in itself, but there is increasing evidence coming out that living in poverty does rise, is associated with an increase in stress response in children, and that may be a limiting factor in their ability to learn.
Well, it makes it hard to concentrate.
That's right.
Definitely when you go to school, especially if you're hungry. So in your study, you use the professional judgment approach. Tell me a little bit about that approach to things. And you mentioned earlier you ended up having professional panels that kind of put best case scenario before you?
Yes. Yeah. Those are fun to convene. So we asked experts from each of the counties that we did the study in to come in and participate. The panels were about 8 to 10 center directors, lead teachers, folks who have deep expertise in this area, often master's degrees or even doctorates, to come in and talk about a simulation where we said we have 100 children in a school. We want to get them all kindergarten ready. They're 3- and 4-year-olds. Tell us the resources that you need to get them there. And then in the second stage, we said, let's increase the percentage of kids coming from disadvantaged backgrounds to 25%, eventually to 100%. And then we added in a 10% population of children with special needs. And so as we layered in that complexity, we talked about how the resource package would vary. And we used a modified consensus approach. So we asked the panelists, some people had different views as to what they thought the right resource levels were. And what was enjoyable is just to hear them kind of fight it out and talk about their own personal experience and then reach agreement on the levels that they felt were needed.
That's got to be interesting also for them to be able to kind of, you know, hear from other people that are experiencing the same challenges.
It really, really – I think one of the reasons that I chose the methodology is to engage these experts in a conversation that they've actually never – believe it or not, never really had. They've never said, what resource levels do we need to get these kids ready? They're too busy just trying to get kids ready. And so there was a – I think hopefully, you know, my goal was in part to – sort of bridge the divide between talking about the economics of education and kindergarten readiness with experts in the field. And to some extent, I hope we accomplish that. Maybe some of the panelists will call in and let us know.
All right. Well, we have a call coming in from Deb in Sanibel. Deb, what would you like to ask?
Hi. I am a pastor out here in Sanibel, and our church started a preschool about 4 years ago. So I can relate to a lot of the cost and the teacher ratios and all that you've been talking about. However, one of the things I was surprised at was the actual standards that they expect our kids to have in kindergarten. I recall kindergarten as being more about one of these things does not look like the other. And the evaluations that we do at the end of their last year in pre-K is asking them to do some basic math, to be ready to read. And I've seen a lot of pressure put on both the kids and the parents as a result. So I was wondering, as you looked at these readiness for kindergarten, did you look at how those standards actually relate to where they really are developmentally, and are we putting too much pressure on them?
That is a really good question, and that was a large part of the study. That was one of the, I think, the first chapter, which was defining what is kindergarten ready. So what does a kid need to go walking into kindergarten?
That's a great question. And Deb, thank you very much for your call. And my my early childhood professors back on campus are cheering your call. We are definitely, I think, on the same page with what you're getting at. First of all, I want to say the study composed a panel first to set the standards for kindergarten readiness. The panelists adopted the Florida Early Learning and Development Standards for four-year-olds. So we actually have a set of state standards out there. There are, I believe, between 11 and 14 domains of readiness within that standard. So it's a very robust set of standards. Some might call that a whole child approach to kindergarten readiness. It's not narrowly focused on literacy or numeracy. It's a much broader scope that looks at social well-being and awareness. Really what we're looking for here is we're not expecting kids to, our 3 and 4 year olds to come into kindergarten being able to read, but they should know what letters are, that they represent and can form sounds around them. They should have some phonemic awareness and those emerging literacy skills we do want to see there. But what's important here is that we think when we create an environment where kids feel safe and where they have an opportunity for extended learning, where they're learning a structure of play that lets them learn while they play and explore new objects and new relationships, that those are the conditions under which the kids will hit the mathematics standards and the reading standards balls out of the park. It's the resources that we're talking about here are needed to get those classrooms, formed in a way where we have the right supports, the right expertise in the room, and a safe and welcoming learning environment for those children.
And some of those standards that were put forward as far as kindergarten ready, and I looked at those 14 points. A lot of them had to do with curiosity and the interest in asking questions and kind of like almost a desire to learn and that kind of curiosity.
Yeah.
And is that something that's formed in pre-K where kids kind of learn that I would like to know more about this and this is how I would ask it questions, or I want to – like wanting to discover things? Is that kind of a seed that is set with a child when they're put in like a learning situation?
That's a great – I think that's how we all learn actually. I don't think it's unique and endemic in all of us. What I think the concern that Deb may be raising with that call and that all of us have is we don't want to squeeze that style of learning and that curiosity out of children with more money. And we don't want to push into a model where we're not recommending in this study, and the experts I talked to do not recommend, making the 6 hours that we just talked about all about, mathematics and reading.
And reciting the alphabet, yeah.
It's absolutely not that. Though I will say there's new research out there, and I want to be clear about this because there are advocates on both sides. New evidence by Bruce Fuller out of Berkeley, a study that talks about, the use of things like flashcards and practicing the alphabet and guided reading and lots of other activities that are academic skills along with structured playtime, that the combination of those two things and a balance between those two things is the best way to get kids kindergarten ready. And I just direct your listeners to look to that work if they're interested in learning more.
So I wanted to ask a question. I mean, what happened to kids before there was pre-K? And I think a lot of kids are in pre-K programs, 3 and 4 year olds, because they're both parents work. So it's kind of also daycare. There's
Correct.
Custodial care going on there. But they happen to have the side benefit of actually being taught something, which is great, and then trying to get them kindergarten ready. But before that even existed, and when we were in like kind of a single income homes and moms took care of the kids in that old traditional 50s style, were kids going to school less kindergarten ready? And if somebody does go into school now, coming just straight from home, are they at a disadvantage? Are there achievement gaps that can be quantified going forward?
Well, I guess if we go back to that 50s era, and I'm not an education historian. I wish I were.
Yeah, that is a historic
situation.
Yeah,
it really is a good question. So I don't want to speak to it. I think many of us generalize from our own personal experience, our parents' or grandparents' experience, which isn't everybody's experience. But, you know, I will say that I think the world has changed. So I think that this has workforce implications. So I think that in that 50s era, if you weren't kindergarten ready, that was okay because you may have a job that involved a lot more unskilled labor and that you were able to achieve a middle class life with that with those efforts, and that those days are going away. I think we all see that, and we see the returns to a college degree and how high they are compared to students who just graduate with a high school degree or equivalency. So I think that that's a factor that's driving anxiety among parents, because parents are concerned about their child's, you know, success in college and being able to obtain a career that will earn them a living wage and be able to, you know, own a home, raise children, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. But your study talked a little bit about fade-out effects. Can you explain what a fade-out is?
Yeah. So there's a debate in whether or not we should be investing in early childhood education around a study in Tennessee that looked at Head Start investments and whether or not children came from those programs were kindergarten ready. And they found that they were actually ahead in many cases of their peers who didn't attend Head Start. But then what they found is those kids regressed toward the mean across first, second grade and beyond. And so folks who said we shouldn't invest in Head Start are pointing to that study and saying, see, it's a waste of time. These kids are going to essentially catch up to their peers anyway. So in other words, the idea is that we're teaching kids skills that they are going to learn in kindergarten, first or second grade anyway. So we're just kind of wasting taxpayer money. There's a new study out I want to point your listeners to. It just came out by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's a working paper. And if you go on my Twitter account, it's my handle is at edfigui, E-D-F-I-G-U-I. I tweeted about that, so you can find the link there. We can put it up after this discussion as well on your website, Julie. But what they found is that children who come out of Head Start programs often ended up in under-resourced elementary schools. And this is a well-known phenomenon because kids who live in high-poverty areas often end up in elementary schools that are under-resourced. In particular, they end up in Title I schools, and Title I schools are the schools that most frequently have brand-new teachers. And if there's one thing we know about education for certain is that the years of experience a teacher has a positive relationship with student learning outcomes. So those schools are often kind of have a turnstile at the door, if you will, because teachers get in there, they earn a few years of experience, and they frequently transfer out to schools that aren't Title I. So kids from the study from Head Start who ended up in under-resourced schools, their learning advantages did fade out. But kids who ended up in schools that were well-resourced with high-quality teaching, though the effects of Head Start did not fade out. In fact, they were built upon. So I think it's a more nuanced understanding, and it kind of makes sense, right, that if you invest early and, like I like to say, early and often, I think that's the best investment strategy to get kids college and career ready, which is our ultimate goal.
Well, and speaking about investments, the investment that you're making even in pre-K is in some instances more expensive annually than college. I mean, I think that's kind of shocking to a lot of parents.
That's a really good point, Julie. So I think that when you look at VPK, which many parents say that $2,300, $2,400 investment, that's a very low level of spending. It's Florida's ranked 41st in the U.S. in terms of spending on four-year-olds, but has 80% of its students participating in it. So they have very high access but very low funding levels. So there's a trade-off there. But that $2,300 investment, what's interesting, when you talk to parents about it, they say that was the year where I had to spend the least on my child's preschool. because at least finally the state stepped in and gave me some support, right?
Yeah, but I remember when my daughter went from 3 to 4 year olds, I was like, yes, it was so great.
Jackpot.
But
so,
still, you end up as a parent putting money into it.
But if we take that gap, right, of what we're saying funding level should be around 12,000, you take off the 2,300, the difference is, $9,000 and change. Sure, at Florida Southwestern State College, tuition and fees per year are running about $3,400. So that's a significant jump for families. So the real fear is preschool, not necessarily paying for college, which is which actually, when you really think about it, makes sense because there's a strong custodial component here, right? You can't have really large class sizes with really young children. It's just not safe.
Yeah, that's true. So the cover of this study lists a number of community partners, mm-hmm. and you mentioned earlier that you wouldn't have been able to do this without them.
Yeah.
Where did their interest in this kind of information come from?
Well, first, if I can just say that the key partner here is FSW and our president, President Albritton, our provost, Dr. Stewart, have really started to invest in research. And this is a key product of that. It's just one small example that as a strategic priority, our college can make an important contribution in this space to our community and our region. The other partners here are Future Ready Collier and Future Makers. Those are both community coalitions. You may have heard about them, collective impact coalitions. And they are interested. Both of them have identified early learning as one of their key reasons for being, really. Because of the kindergarten readiness rates and gaps that we talked about earlier mm-hmm. and the lack of investment in early childhood education. So they saw this as a key piece to their efforts. And then the Children's Movement is a statewide advocacy group founded by Dave Lawrence, the former editor of the Miami Herald. And so we've been working with that group as well just to get our goal in this work is to say we don't know how much a high-quality early childhood education costs. We should know. As a college, we want to go and help the community figure that out.
And now then, we do know.
And then educate them about our findings, and that's what we're doing here today.
At least you know what you're starting with and then where you need to start looking for those.
Well, now we've got to develop policy alternatives to fill the gap.
Yeah,
and that's what we're going to do next.
Try to get those dollars afloat. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now because we've run out of time, but I want to thank our guest, Dr. Larry Miller, the dean of FSW's School of Education. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Coming up, we'll talk with a flag expert and the curator of the Military Museum and Library of Southwest Florida about a unique antique added to their collection during yesterday's Flag Day ceremony. More on that piece of U.S. history that now calls the Cape Coral Museum home in just a few minutes. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.